Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. Today is a day when the children and the families of Newtown, Connecticut are on all of our minds. And it's produced some sobering thought for me. As many of you know, I've been an expert in some cases that have been similar to this, including in some cases surrounding Columbine. And I've written about it extensively in terms of the possibility of psychiatric drug involvement. But I want to emphasize today that we're looking at something so much larger than that. Because with or without psychiatric drugs, we're still going to be having violent people who feel compelled, for whatever reason, to kill many other human beings. And it makes me to realize the broadness of this tragedy. We don't know whether or not this 20-year-old was on psychiatric drugs. There's a mention in the Washington Post that a family member said he was on medication. The police have said no medications were found in the house. But we know he must have been in psychiatric treatment along the way, if not at the moment, coming from a wealthy family. Educated, they're going to be trying the standard psychiatric approach, at least for a period of time. But I want to emphasize that beyond that, as long as people do have ready access, such ready access to such devastating arms, we're always going to be at risk for escalation. I've come to emphasize this reluctantly in many ways, given my individual rights orientation. But there's simply no way of escaping, no way at all, that what happened in Newtown just almost certainly couldn't have happened in that catastrophic level without the availability of semi-automatic weapons with clips capable of carrying 30 rounds of ammunition and without the ability to train with them, perhaps, since it looks like his mother took him shooting. We also have to deal with societal issues. We have to deal with reaching out in the schools to people who were withdrawn. Today we'll be talking about family life. We've got to keep working on family life issues in America. Well, let me introduce my guest, who certainly may have more to say about this. Carolyn, are you there? Well, Carolyn is simply a wonderful person. Her name is Carolyn Crowder, C-R-O-W-D-E-R. In a minute, I'll tell you just how wonderful I think she is by demonstration. And she's calls herself a retired psychologist. I guess that's because she's not in private clinical practice anymore. She works a lot doing parent education, training people in an effective philosophy, a practical philosophy based on the methods of Alfred Adler and Rudolf Dreikers. In fact, she's been doing that for 40 years. She's worked in a variety of of trying settings, prison, court, incest treatment programs, university counseling centers, and public schools, relevant to the tragedy I was just talking about. Carolyn's published three parenting books, Back Talk, Whining, and Eating, Sleeping, and Getting Up. Back Talk, I believe, is the one that was the bestseller on the New York Times list, and as a result of that, she did a huge amount of media. She describes herself in her bio on our advisory council list. She's an advisory council member of the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, Education and Living, the center my wife and I started. She's a member of Mother Bear, which is a marvelous new organization, which you can Google, and which I'm also proud to be affiliated with, a group that we're hoping will provide a better alternative for families who need support in dealing with offspring who are having trouble in life. But here's the real demonstration of my affection and trust for Carolyn Crowder. We're writing a book together. We're just in the early drafts of it and having a very good time. And it's going to be a book that, on the one hand, tells parents how and why to avoid psychiatric drugs and how and why to handle the system and negotiate through it with your kids, and then talks very specifically and in detail about raising kids. So, hello, Carolyn Crowder.
Thank you, Peter.
Where would you like to begin?
Well, let me begin by talking about social interest and how we raise our children to be compassionate and empathic for others. I find that with most other kinds of parent help that people get, there's not a focus on this. And in fact, a lot of parenting materials are based on behavior modification, which is you reward good behavior and punish bad. And I happen to think that's the dead opposite of what you ought to be doing. One reason I'm an Adlerian psychologist is because Adler talked about the need for parents and schools to bring out the sort of natural ability to empathize with others that our children have. And I think it happens at times, but I don't think we're as conscientious about the need to do it as we should be. And what I mean by that is little kids, starting out when they're toddlers, need to be given avenues of contribution, and so that they can feel useful. And the more useful a child feels, the less behavior problems you have with them, because we're all, including kids, looking for a way to belong, and we want to feel significant. And if I'm allowed and encouraged to do it positively, I will do that. If not, I or any child would fall into attention-getting, power, revenge, and those kinds of things, things that we drug for now. So I think it's important that people understand this concept and thereby allow the toddlers. Toddlers always want to work. They always want to vacuum and dust and water the plants and feed the dog and all the things that have to be done every week, every day in families. And many people tell their kids, you're too young. You can do it later. But what happens is when you do that, you've missed an opportunity to allow them to belong that way, and so they will go toward the negative for to feel significant and important. It's what Adler and Dreikers called a misguided attempt to belong, because it's antisocial. It's against the good of the group, the family group. It's not helping, it's hindering.
I like this a lot. I think what you're saying is very fundamental to some of the problems we're having. We're simply not thinking consciously enough in our families, but also in our schools, to raise children to be caring, empathic, loving human beings. Adler's concept of social interest in more contemporary language, perhaps. I think it bears a lot on the events we've seen with every one of the shooters. I don't want to spend more than another sentence or two on that today, but pretty much all the shooters we look at, whether it's Cho at in Virginia Tech, or whether it's Eric Harris in Colorado, or whether it's the Aurora, Colorado shooter, and so on, they are shy, withdrawn people who never fully developed social interest, and exactly as you describe it, lacking meaning in their social lives, in their personal and family lives, they seek meaning through violence, through imposing on others. So I think that the social interest is so apropos for today, but it's also the key to life. Do you want to talk some about practical applications of that, or any place you want to take off on, Caroline? I really want to just hear you talk today.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to say that Adler said that the most socially interested people are the most mentally healthy. So for him, an understanding of mental illness is a lack of social interest. So you're exactly correct about that. It's a misguided focus on the self and what I want and what I need to the detriment of others. I think that what I see in my teaching parents is, and I've been doing it for 40 years, in the old days, there were quite a few people who had to be convinced not to hit their kids or yell and scream or try to parent through fear, which is kind of really the old school. It's the old autocratic school. But 40 years ago, there were still adults trying to do that. And anymore, children, and rightly so, rebel against being hit. What they do is instead of cowering, they give back in equal amounts to what you've done. So the pendulum swung all the way over to indulgence and permissiveness. And that's not good for children either, because there you raise what we like to call tyrants, or kids that rule the roost, that think of nobody else, that do not contribute, but rather cause trouble all the time. And so let me give a real concrete example of how a parent can begin to operate out of the Adlerian model in a real ordinary situation. You take your, let's say, 3 or 4 year old to the grocery store, and they throw themselves on the ground, on the floor, because they want, let's say, a bag of candy they see. They know that you don't allow them to have this kind of candy. So this is really a test for the parents. How are they going to handle it? And everybody faces this with little kids. So you have essentially three approaches. You can either jerk the kid up off the floor, paddle his bottom, threaten him, tell him you're never bringing him to the store again, yell, scream, become embarrassed, all these kinds of autocratic responses. The permissive parent, which is what you see mostly now, they say, be quiet, be quiet, be quiet. And when it doesn't happen, they say, oh, all right, I'll buy it for you. See, everything that parents do in response to misbehavior is training. So when you do that, either one of those positions, you have trained the child what to expect from you. So in the first instance, the child feels very powerful because they have gotten you angry and upset to the point where you're acting out in public. The indulged child got what they wanted. But it's not what they really want. The candy's not the issue. The issue's power. Okay? The candy's what the avenue that the power's being expressed. You have trained them to do it again the next time. That there will either be an angry response where you feel more and more helpless and the child feels more and more powerful, or you've trained them to throw a fit so they can get what they want, which is power as well as the candy. Now, the Adlerian parent would simply say, and the tone of voice is everything, what you say is, I see you have decided for us to leave. I can tell by your behavior. Now, this is said in a factual tone. It's the message is, when you behave this way, we don't stay. And so you take the child by the hand. If they're kicking and screaming, you pick them up. But you do not do anything that denotes annoyance or anger. And this is the hard part for parents. They can learn what to do, but they can't carry it out without really being sucked into the anger and irritation. And once you've shown that, the kid got what they wanted. So you paid it off. So you must be, matter of fact, is the way you would, we always say treat your child the way you would your best friend. So you simply say, we're leaving. Now you go out and you take the child to the car. And what usually happens next is, I'll be good, give me another chance. And we Adlerians don't believe in second chances because we think that's a game. Because I've never known a child who's been given a second chance who then behaves. They just go back and start it again. That's very typical. So we take them and you put them in the car, and they still may be screaming and kicking and crying and give me another chance and all that stuff. But you do not respond, because that's not real communication there. That's power struggles, and it takes two to tango, and so the parent has to not buy into the power struggle. So then you get in the car, and you start driving home. You can listen to music. You can talk about the weather. You can talk about anything except his power struggle, his fit. Now, parents, I find this especially true in American parents, they feel that they're not disciplining if they don't then point out to the child what mama just did or what daddy just did. They say, see what happens when you don't behave in the grocery store? That's not necessary, and it's from the autocratic side. The child knows why you left, despite his protestations. He knows why you left. You simply do not discuss that, and you never bring it up. The most you would say is, we'll try again next Wednesday to go to the grocery store. In the Adlerian model, there's always hope for the future. The child's never doomed, that's the end of it, but rather you are respectful enough to let them know that there'll be another opportunity. And so if the child messes up again, you do the same thing over again. But you do not discuss it. You do not point out the lesson. You do not, American parents keep wanting to talk about it. You just shut up and follow through with the behavior, with your behavior. I like to tell parents, this is a model not for you to manage your child. It's for you to manage your reaction to your child. And that's really all you have control over. And that's a real respectful way to be, is to manage your own reactions, your own emotions, and train the child how to treat you and how to behave.
Very, very good. Very clear. In the workshop of yours that I attended and enjoyed not long ago, you talked about, what do you do when the child doesn't want to help you, like you come in with the groceries.
Oh, yeah.
That was a fun example.
Yes. Well, this is a good example of asking the child for help and then what to do when they say no. Because our kids are a lot of times very indulged. Nothing's expected of them. We have low expectations for their behavior. We have low expectations that they will help out in the family. And so when you try to implement this model, you have to adopt the attitude of belief that the child will get it, and what I call join the human race, that he will make the right decision eventually. So the parent is the eternal cheerleader, and belief in the kid. The worst thing for a child is for a parent to give up on them. All evidence to the contrary, the parent can still not give up on the child. So you have to maintain your optimism and your belief that eventually the child will get it, and that your job is to train yourself how you're going to respond. So the example Peter's talking about, that you're talking about, Peter, is that that let's say that your 8-year-old kid is watching TV after school one day, and you've been to the grocery store, and you've got like 20 bags of groceries in the car. So you bring in a few bags, and you come in, and you say, "Son, would you help me bring in the groceries?" Now, a lot of indulged children and pampered children would say, "Can't you see I'm watching TV?" Okay. So that is verbal abuse and disrespect from the child. But instead of dealing with that as, "Don't you speak to me that way," which gets you nowhere, one of the things you can do is go and turn off the TV, because the TV is interfering in the social relationship. The toy is interfering in the relationship between siblings, so the toy goes. In this instance, the TV goes. You can do that, or you cannot do that. What you can do instead, and I've recommended this many, many times, and parents never believe that it will work, but it always works, which is you say to the child, "Okay, maybe next time." You turn on your heel and you go back out to the garage to get the rest of the groceries. It is very difficult for a child to sit there and have a look at himself about how he's just treated his mother. This is when you see their real character, because you're not making them, you're not shaming them, you're not bribing them. You're simply saying, "Okay, maybe next time." And parents view this as being weak, but I view this as training. It's not weak at all. Self-control is strong. So what you do is you head out. And in every case that I have ever been reported back to by my families, the kid has jumped up off the couch. So he goes and he starts bringing in and helping you, because kids basically love to help. It's just that we have put it off so long, thinking that they can or that they should, that they are spoiled. And they don't think to help mother out. Now, the big thing is, once he starts helping, you don't reward, you don't gush, you don't carry on, you don't act surprised. You say, "Thanks. That saved me a lot of steps." And so you see, in this model, your language and your tone are very important. They have to be respectful. It has to be kind but firm. Respect, kind, and firm. That's what we're looking for.
Now, in my work with families, I will tell them that, or suggest to them, that the single most important starting point is respectful relating.
Right.
And I encourage them to note that to the kids, that, you know, we're going to start respecting each other now. I said, don't have a big discussion, but mm-hmm. point out that things are going to change today, and from now on, there's only going to be respectful communications,
mm-hmm.
and that the most effective thing they can do is to simply not pay attention to disrespectful communications, certainly never given to them, but perhaps note them that in some way you're disappointed by the disrespect. What about that? Do you have a somewhat different approach to that basic issue?
I don't, except it's a matter of timing. I think that conversation is fine. I would do it like at bedtime, not at the moment that it's happened, but later in the day or the next morning, and I get the kid alone, and I say, "You know, son, last night when you spoke to me that way, that was an example of disrespect, and I want you to stop. I'm working hard not to be disrespectful to you, and I want you to work hard not to be disrespectful to me, because that's the kind of family life we want." So that's about two sentences, okay, and that's all I would say. Our parents overtalk. They just talk and talk and talk, and they nag and nag, and they beg, and they plead, and they remind, and they coax, and they fuss, and they get mad, and none of it serves the relationship, none of it. You wouldn't do that to your best friend. Why are you doing it to a little kid?
I think one of the things that to me is very striking with, you know, my own use of similar approach is how quickly chaotic families warm up and start treating each other with respect after maybe just one discussion with the parents about changing their approach, especially to this respect issue and to basically to similar approaches that you're using. Let's go back even earlier and talk about, you know, the basic socializing process when you have a little child who's just getting the idea of mine, getting the idea of ownership and not wanting to share and wanting to share and so on. And, you know, think of a real youngster, toddler maybe. And perhaps tell us a little bit about some of what you learned about handling those situations to encourage this most fundamental thing of all, which is caring, empathy, cooperation.
Well, I think the place you start is where I began this conversation, which is you be sure that you allow that toddler to help, because that takes care of a lot of problems right there. If they want to wash the dishes, get a step stool, get plastic plates, and let them do that, because then they see themselves as contributing and is important in the family. Now, the other things about that's my toy, you can't play with it, I think we always have to be careful that we don't make an issue out of it, or we don't create a problem that wasn't there. That's kind of normal development thing for a child. I think I would say one sentence to the child is, I'd like for you to share that with your buddy over here. The child doesn't, I would turn and walk away. Because I think things like apologizing and sharing should never be forced. You know, it should be up to the child. And I think you model what you want, you show them how to do it, but then you back off. Because if you don't, if you begin to force it, to try to force it, it becomes an arena for a power struggle. It's like forcing a child to eat. You're not getting down from the table till you eat. You are asking for trouble. You're creating a problem that's not fair. Rather let the kid go hungry. Rather let the kid's little friend not want to come over and play because he won't share. You see what I'm saying? So you let life's lessons teach the child. You do a minimal amount of interference and then model what you want and treat the child the way you want to be treated. And we have to socialize kids. You know, they come in. You know, people always say to me, toddlers are so self-centered and so forth. I don't know that if I agree with that, because if you think about when you're out and about, and let's say there's a toddler in the mall who has fallen and is crying, and you've got your toddler by the hand, what the reaction I see is that little kid of yours is real interested in that other child and what's going on with him and why is he crying, and they look over there and they want to pull over there and they want to see about it. That's the natural empathy coming out. That's the social interest, and we need to appreciate it as that. And so it's there in toddlers. It's up to the parents and later the teachers to foster it and to bring it out.
Carolyn, we're going to go to a break in about a minute or a minute and a half or so. Can you tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Well, I'm happy to receive emails. Is that what you mean? And if somebody has a question or if they want to get the names of my books or whatever, my books are all on Amazon. So, and there are many areas in this country where there are leering and parent study groups that they could participate in. So I would encourage people to think about what they're doing and that everything they do in response to their child is training the child. Everything, good and bad, is training the child how to treat you and how to be. So my email address is CarolynCrowder@me.com. It's a MAC address.
Carolyn spelled as commonly spelled, and Crowder, C-R-O-W-D-E-R.
Right.
Go ahead.
At me.com.
Now, I don't usually encourage callers on this show because we're just always so involved, the guests, and my guests have so much to say. But I think this, if one or two folks want to call in specifically with questions about child rearing, this might be a very appropriate place to do that. But I know it's not the habit, and perhaps no one will get to do that. But I think it might be today it might be a particularly worthwhile thing to do. The theme is social interest, empathy, caring, how to bring that out in your child, how to do it by managing yourself rather than the child, and by creating an environment of caring and respect. We can go to break now, bring on the music, and we'll be back in 1 minute or two or three. And this is Dr. Peter Greggin. And since I don't usually invite callers, we don't have that phone number at the break. But you can call in at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Carolyn, hi. You can start on any subject you want anytime, but if you like, it might be interesting to talk some more about maybe siblings and their fighting, which is, gosh, such a terrible problem. And then another issue that you might want to get into is getting up in the morning and going to bed at night. Some of the basic issues that make parents crazy and create conflict.
Okay, I'll be happy to. As far as siblings go, my major professor used to say that brothers and sisters are no more cooperative than when they're fighting, because they're usually cooperating to get mom involved. Parents have trained kids that they will referee, they will figure out who started it, they will mete out punishment for who's at fault, and really, if you had a video camera hidden somewhere, you would see that the poor victim is usually in there equal to the persecutor in these fights. So you never want to be a referee. You never want to get into it, because it's just a dead end. There is get angry and upset, and it never settles anything. So what I usually say to parents is that if they don't believe me and they're at home with their kids and the kids are fighting, instead of trying to intervene, go to the bathroom and shut the door. And 9 times out of 10, those children will follow you and fight outside the bathroom door. Now, that should tell you something. That should tell you that it's for your benefit and that they are cooperating to get you involved. And so you just wait until it gets quiet and you go out. Now, what you have to resist doing is saying, I've told y'all before not to fight. I can't stand it. I don't want any part of it. You just do the action. You go, you disappear, and then you come out when it's quiet. Same kind of thing in a car when children are fighting in a car. That's one of the easiest things to learn how to handle, is that you simply pull over and stop at the nearest safe place, and you sit there, and you always have a book with you, or you have the radio on, and you say nothing. And the children are fighting, and finally they go, Mom, we got to go, I'm going to miss whatever. And you just go, I can't drive when there's too much racket, it's too dangerous. So you see that you're not addressing the child per se, but you're addressing the social situation. The situation is, I don't drive, or I don't stay in the room when there's fighting. I don't drive when there's fighting in the back seat. And so that's what I do. I don't drive. So this is you managing yourself, see, and your response. So they will learn that if they want to get anywhere, or if they don't want to be bored sitting by the side of the road, they will get quiet. And it works every time. These things work very, as you were talking about in your practice, they work very quickly, very quickly. I remember one dad came up to me after one of my classes. I had 100 people in it. And he came up to me and he said, this is the first week of peace I've ever had since the kids were born. And it was simply a matter of him changing his behavior, being very aware of it, and keeping his mouth shut largely, just taking action. This is the same dad, let me say, that whose 13-year-old was mad at him about something. He was standing in her doorway of her bedroom and lecturing her, and she slammed the door in his face. And so having taken a class or two for me, He shouldn't have been standing there lecturing to begin with, but anyway, that's what he did. He goes out to the garage and gets a screwdriver and comes back and undoes the hinges and takes the door off, whereupon she had a full-blown temper tantrum that she needed her privacy, that she was 13 and she must have her privacy, and he just stood there and looked at her, not angrily, not mean, but this is what I tell parents to say to themselves, not to say it to the child, but to say to themselves, I don't get it. You slammed the door in my face. I'm taking the door down. I don't get what the problem is. Because, see, in his mind, and what you want the kids to learn is what we call logical consequences, which is whatever the consequence is, it follows from the misbehavior. So slam door, door gone. And you never really have to say anything to the child one way or the other. But what she did was, as most kids will do this, they will escalate. They'll get angrier. They'll ask for a second chance. They'll cry and scream, and they'll carry on. And you stand there for a few seconds, and then you turn and leave. And I like for parents to adopt a position of what I call befuddlement, which is don't feel the need to explain what you did. They get it. Don't justify yourself. They know why you did it. You say to yourself, I'm confused, door slammed, door gone. And so that's what you're thinking, but you don't have to say anything. So a few weeks later, he said he saw her having another hissy fit, and she was going out in the garage, and she opened the door real hard, real far back to slam it, and she stopped mid-slam. So she learned her lesson. He didn't have to say a word. And after a while, when he got ready, he put the door back on. He never said one thing about it. So that's the kind of action and thinking that is very effective, and it's respectful on top of it, because you're not lambasting the kid and you're not reminding and doing all those things that are not respectful. You are simply doing what you're setting your standard for how you want to be treated in your house. And if parents don't do that, it becomes anarchy. It gets out of hand. Parents have to be the leaders and the guides, not the boss, not the best friend. The boss is the autocratic methods, and the best friend is the indulgent. Your kids have their own friends. They don't need you. What they need you for is a teacher and a trainer for how to behave and how to treat other people, first people being their parents. So as far as like daily kinds of problems with little kids, eating is a big issue in a lot of homes, where you'll have three good eaters and a fourth one who is picky and won't eat and doesn't like anything. Or maybe you'll have more than one. It just depends on the dynamics in the family. But you should never, number one, you never cook individual meals. You cook a meal for the family. This is your contribution. You're not a servant. You are a mom or dad who's contributing to the life of the family by cooking this meal. The child has the right not to eat it if they don't like it. That's it. That's the whole thing in a nutshell. Now, you can either, so the consequence is a natural one, which is hunger. And no child is going to starve themselves. So what you do is you, now I know there are kids who are anorexic. That usually comes older, and that's another whole issue altogether. But this is this early training so that the child learns that mom cooked, I'll eat. Now, you can either allow them to make themselves a sandwich, which I would not do. I would prefer that the child go hungry, and the next meal they'll be glad to have. You know, most of the world's children do not have enough to eat, and we're worried about one meal here. So I think you stand back and you say, okay, you don't have to eat it. You can either let the child sit there and be part of the conversation, or you can take the plate up and they can leave or whatever. The point is you don't get all hot and bothered about it, and you don't give them dessert so they'll eat, and you don't do all those kinds of things, and you don't put yourself in their service. They need to learn. Their cooperation is to eat what's there. Your cooperation is that you made the meal to begin with, and that's it. I mean, you know, another thing is that you can cook a meal, and it's the chores have been divided up, and it's 5-year-old's turn to set the table, and you go out with the pot of spaghetti, and there's no plates and no forks. Well, you have a choice. I had one lady who came and just put the spaghetti right on the table. I mean, on the table, like where the place serving should be. And the kids, it was a laugh. You know, the kids never forgot it, though, and they never forgot doing their job. But you can turn around and take it, put it in the freezer for tomorrow night. You can take it to the neighbor. You can take it to the soup kitchen. You can do whatever you want to with it. But since the plates and the forks are not there, you guess that they've decided not to eat. Now, you don't, even though it's little Susie's job, you don't say, well, Susie didn't put the forks out and the plates out, so we're not eating. You don't go there. You just say, there are no forks and plates, so I put it in the freezer. And, you know, everybody misses a meal. It's not a big deal, but it trains the children to be respectful and to think of their job that they have said that they would do. So, you know, that's part of that contribution and cooperation. We are big advocates for sharing the maintenance of the household, so that a kid does laundry, but not just his laundry. He does the whole family's laundry, or they vacuum all the rooms, or they, you know, whatever. That it's not just me taking care of me, it's me taking care of mom. And that's what you want. So,
let me ask you another question around eating.
Yeah.
Because I just want to draw you out. Now, when you have little babies, they can be very finicky with what they eat. One of my grandchildren pretty much wanted chicken fingers and hummus for most of his meals in the beginning. And my daughter, Allie, who is just a marvelous, thoughtful mom, she, for a long time, allowed that diet as he chose it to go on.
Uh-huh.
He grew like a stalk. He's probably beyond the 99th percentile in a balanced way in height and weight. And then gradually she, as he got a little older, he's now 4 or 5, she began to say, now you have to have some of this and you have to have some of that. Mm-hmm. But she went very slowly about that. And I'm just wondering, again, just give you an opportunity to reflect.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's okay. I think her not getting angry and irritated about it is a big plus, and that kept it out of the power struggle arena. She was, you know, if she's willing to cook those special things for him, that's her choice, but don't be angry or worried about it. Just do it. And so it kind of worked itself out. But when you've got four children who are
right,
demanding different things.
This was the first one.
Yeah. Then you're racing around, and you never want to train children to put others in their service. And mothers are bad about that. They wait on the child hand and foot, because that does not encourage independence. It doesn't encourage social interest. You know, and they view you as a doormat. And that gives them then the license to talk back and treat you badly. So self-respect is primary. You have to say, okay, I'm willing to do this, and I'm not going to be upset about it. Or I'm not willing to do it, and I'm not going to be upset about it. But, you know, you set your boundaries for what you are willing to do and not do. And that's really, to me, if you respect yourself, the children will respect you.
She is extremely good at that. And now comes along our second grandson, and he, from what I gather, just eats anything.
Not an issue.
He wants more and different.
Yeah.
So there is that huge variation in kids.
Right.
As you talk, the issue of love doesn't come up spontaneously mm-hmm. as much as the issues of discipline.
Right.
Address that. I find that really interesting, because I know you're a very loving person, and so was Adler,
yeah.
Your ultimate mentor. So talk some about that.
Well, that's because I use discipline the way other people would talk about love, because I think it is love. I think it's love in action. It's easier to let children off the hook, you know, with their bad behavior, or to be overbearing with them. Those are easier things, but thoughtful self-respect and the idea of training your child by your own actions requires a lot of self-control and a lot of love for the child. I think you know, the word discipline, it comes from the same word as disciple, so that discipline is an act of training in love. It's the most loving thing you can do, because it's the hardest thing to do well. And to put your mind to it and not raise a child who is out of hand or who is frightened of you, but raise a kid who knows how to be in the world, who knows how to take care of himself, who knows how to think about others, that's a very loving thing to do. And so, to me, they're one and the same. Discipline is love in action.
Well put. I think I would add to it that when you treat children with this kind of respect, based on self-respect for yourself and the relationship, the natural, spontaneous, loving tendencies in all of us get a chance to flower without pushing or encouragement. It just comes right out of us when we are in situations that are just well handled, I think.
Yes, yes. And, you know, let me give an example from my school. I had a little child one day that I was talking to about his behavior, and he got mad with me. And he walked out and slammed the door. He was about a fifth grader. And he walked out on me. And I care a lot for this kid, but, you know, this is when discipline comes into play, because I thought, that was disrespectful of me. What do I do now? So a lot of people would have followed him and given him a lecture about rudeness and slamming the door in your face. I'm not about to do that. Number two is to, sort of sugarcoat it and not deal with it. I'm not going to do that either. So what happened is I didn't do anything, and I went into his classroom a couple days later to get another child, and I felt these arms around my waist, and I looked down, and it was that kid, and he said, I'm sorry, I slammed the door in your face. Now, and that produces love. You're absolutely right. It's like, you know why? Because I got to see who this kid is. I didn't make that happen. I didn't demand it. I didn't overlook it. I got to see what his character was. And lots of times our kids have very good characters, but we are so busy trying to control the situation that we don't get to see that. That's like the boy jumping up to help you with the groceries. If you try to control that situation, make him do it or make him feel bad or whatever, then it becomes about that instead of about his lack of contribution to you. So when you just go, okay, well, maybe next time, you're showing optimism and you go out the door and they can't resist it. They absolutely can't resist it. And I think we have to, I always talk about the fact of what the waiting. We've forgotten how to wait. We want to get in there and manage it right away. Instead of just saying, okay, like I did, I just didn't do anything. Now, had he not said anything to me, the next counseling session, I would have approached it. I would have said, you know, last week when you went out and slammed the door, this is how I felt about it, and this is what I'd like you to do instead if you're angry with me. Now, and most kids respond that, because that's so respectful, and it's putting it on their shoulders where they know it needs to be, because they did it. But in this case, I didn't even have to. I mean, he came right up and took responsibility. And we have to wait long enough to get to see these things and give up our need to correct it or to control it. We have big needs for that.
Carolyn, let me give you a situation that many parents feel is the downfall of their family life.
Mm-hmm.
You start off the morning, your kid doesn't want to get up,
mm-hmm.
and the kid gets up as if calculating every minute of it. The kid dawdles until
mm-hmm.
they're going to miss the school bus
mm-hmm.
or the ride to school.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that a little, would you?
I sure will, because it's very common. What you need to do is, you know, if you've been starting out your day in, like, World War III, fighting with the kids about getting up, eat, get your backpack, all that kind of stuff we go through, it's so stressful. Nobody needs the stress. The kid doesn't need it, and you don't need it. So what you do is you decide you're going to change your behavior. So what you say to the child is, from now on, I am not going to be waking you up. You're old enough. You know, if it's not, you know, let's say it's a third grader, second, third grader, not a kindergartner or nursery school. But the older child, you would say, I am not going to wake you up. That's disrespectful of you because you're old enough to do it yourself. What we're going to do is go to the grocery store or to the hardware store, whatever, and buy you an alarm clock. You can go with me and pick it out. I'm going to show you how to operate it, and it's up to you. So the kids, of course, they like the alarm clock idea. They like learning how to set it. They like all of that stuff. It doesn't mean they're really going to get up, though. So what you have to do is exercise self-discipline and not go in there at all anymore. And the first morning is going to be a test of you because you've already said what you're going to do. Now they want to see if you're going to do it. So you go on about your business, you know, cook breakfast, get ready, whatever you're going to do, and you never go in the room, and you don't hear any motion in there. So you're starting to get antsy, but you don't give in to the antsiness. You just keep about your business. Now, you've also told them, as I like to say, the train leaves at 7:45 or whatever. You know, you've let them know that if they're not ready, there's two things that are going to happen. And it's not a threat. It's a statement of fact. Either you're going to miss going to school, in which case you have gotten the neighbor lined up to come over and sit with the child all day, or they go as is, which means pajamas. So if they're still in the bed when it's 7:45, you go in there and pick them up like a sack of potatoes, no energy behind it, or I call it no heat behind it. Pick them up, put them in the car, and take them to school. Now, you can take their clothes and their shoes and stuff and put it in the back seat, and they carry it in and go in the bathroom and change or whatever. I mean, you know, this happened all the time at our school where the kids would just walk into the teacher's, to the principal's office bathroom next door and change, and nobody would say a word to them about it because we were trying to train them to get up in the morning and take responsibility. So,
by the way, I want to just interject. I think that's a very important part of it because I wouldn't want to shame the child.
No, you don't shame them.
It's I want people to know that you're clear about that.
Yes, no shame ever. It's like it's on your shoulders to get up and get going. It's no longer my job. I have other things to do, and you're old enough to do this yourself. That's respect. That's a respectful message. Then you must follow through with it. Now, when I mentioned having the neighbor come over, if the kids ride a school bus, you know, and they miss the bus, you only what. But I tell people, go, oh, my God, that's so, you know, I have the neighbor over there every day, you know. But no, you, with children, especially young children, you only have to do it once. They just have to see that you intend to follow through and that if worse comes to worse, the neighbor's ready and you can sit all day, you know, and not do too much that's fun. You just are home all day missing your friends and missing going to school. And it's never remarked upon. You don't come home from work whatever you're doing during the day, you don't come home and say, see what happened when you didn't get ready? You never say that. This is such the important part because the kids got some discipline from your action. You don't need to reinforce it with your words because then it quickly turns into a power struggle. So you just...
Marilyn, we have 2 minutes left,
yes.
Literally, a little less. Say something about bedtime.
About what? Bedtime? Oh.
Bedtime.
Well, bedtime, it's important to have structure in a child's life, and so you have a structured bedtime. You put them down. Usually the little ones will get up and come in and want some water or call you or so forth, and you let them know that you're going to come in once and no more or not at all. You let them know ahead of time this is the way we're going to manage it, and then you just follow through. And I don't believe in the family bed. I don't believe in children sleeping with parents because I don't think it fosters their own self-confidence and their own independence. I think they need to have their own space, their own bed, their own bedroom. And that's part of that respect, them for the parents for them. And so I think structure and follow through. Whatever is comfortable for your family as far as structure goes, but make sure that once you've established it that you do it with as few words as possible.
Carolyn, you're really good at this.
After 40 years, I ought to be.
Carolyn, folks, has teased me that I'm a natural Adlerian. But
yes.
I went down into the basement of my office and opened some cartons I hadn't opened for 10 years last week and found that I'm not a natural Adlerian. I had 6 or 7 Adlerian books in the basement, including the Ansbacher or Ansbacher
book. Yeah.
So I was steeped in this stuff on my own, reading as a college kid in my spare time. Thank you, Carolyn Crowder, for being on the show.
Thank you, Peter.
Very, very informative.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
We'll be right back.